Andre! Andre! Wake up, buddy!
I don't want to go to school, Mama.
Andre! Wake up, buddy! It's time to do the show!
Five more minutes, hit the snooze.
Andre! Come on, buddy! You can do this!
What's going on?
That's right! Here is your host of the Negative Positives Podcast, all the way from sunny California, Andre Dominguez.
Welcome back to the Negative Positives Podcast, episode number 254. I am your co-host, Andre Dominguez, coming at you from the City of Angels with another solo show. Today, I'm going to be talking a little bit about the new HP printer that I have. I know that I gave a little bit of an update on the last episode where we recorded with Mr. Brian Caparicci, but I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity to give a little bit deeper of a first impression of it, talk a little bit about what my plan is regarding the first, you know, pack of or ink cartridge and pack of photo paper that came with the printer, and then we have a few a call and camera review, as well as a really exciting email from one of our listeners, friends, and fellow podcasters. So starting off with the printer itself, as we all know, the beloved Mr. Mike Gutterman is quite the trendsetter when it comes to the film photography community, and he's long been extolling the virtues of the legendary HP Instant Ink program, and praising, but mockingly wondering how the hell they actually end up making money and not losing a bunch, given how amazing of a deal the Instant Ink program is. To any of the uninitiated that haven't listened to the many, many times that we've talked about it, essentially the HP Instant Ink program is this thing that HP has going on where they will... There's different kind of tiers depending on how many sheets you print per month, but essentially, they will monitor the rate at which you go through the ink and send you new ink anytime that your printer is running low. So I believe the tier that I'm at right now is $5 a month for 100 sheets a month with a rollover. I think it's like 100 sheets per month, maxing out at 200. So essentially, if I don't use all 100 sheets within that allotted month, some of it will roll into the next month, so that the next month I can do, you know, 300 or something like that. I don't have the actual plan open up here in front of me, but what that essentially allows you to do is, if I wanted to print 100 8x10s in a month, I could, with only paying $5, and at any point during that, as long as I was keeping my usage rather consistent, the software would be tracking my ink usage and sending me new ink whenever it was running low. Now, as Mike, you know, kind of told me and warned me, it's going to take a little bit of time for it to, you know, measure how much ink you're going through, send it out with the appropriate lead time and shipping estimates in order for it to arrive exactly when you need it. But for all intents and purposes, you know, you're paying $5 for the opportunity to print 100 anything. Now, granted, that does mean that I think, as far as I've been able to research, it is just kind of counting the sheets. So at the moment, I'm only printing 4x6s, but you definitely could extrapolate that out to the largest size that it can do, which is 8x10. I'm not at the point right now where I'm really kind of comfortable printing a whole lot of 8x10s. As I mentioned on the last episode, I'm using this opportunity to, and the fact that it came with a 100 pack of their just like standard glossy 4x6 photo paper, to really kind of knock down my huge backlog of prints that were sent to me by listeners. And some of you guys were over the, I think, almost a year and a half that I've been on the podcast with Mike, been so incredibly generous, sending amazing darkroom prints. I have a huge print that was made by Bryce Randall that I know that, you know, sending a dinky little, you know, inkjet 4x6 print is nowhere near paying you guys back for the time and effort that you put in. But I'm hoping that this is, you know, just the start. With us having, you know, a full up and running darkroom at the new CineStill headquarters that we're going to start moving into, hopefully this Friday or Saturday. I definitely hope to be, you know, printing more in the darkroom, printing larger, but it's undeniable how much of a bang for your buck this HP printer is. For those that are interested in the model that I ended up choosing, I chose the HP Envy 5055. It's just, you know, a standard kind of all-in-one printer in their, like, you know, photo line. Does all the standard things that you'd expect. I have been keeping it here on my just on my desk, and it's kind of become my little, like, home office printer as well. Prior to that, I really didn't have one, so, you know, printing off the things that I need for notes for recording solo shows, printing personal documents, everything like that, it's actually nice having a printer at home now. And the fact that I can just, you know, switch out the 8.5 by 11 printer paper and pop in some glossy 4x6 paper and literally just, you know, open up my folders of my hard drive, go through and select a few images and you know, hit print, and they come out pretty darn good, has been really great. As to the quality overall of the images, many of you guys have seen Mike's torture tests with this instant ink program and a combination of multiple different paper stocks, and you'll know that these things are pretty darn good for what the price is, both for the printer itself. Mine was a $120 printer that was on sale for $49.99, as well as the paper. I mean, I have noticed that the darkest shadows on this HP advanced, I don't know if it's advanced, but this HP glossy photo paper do tend to get a little muddy, a little bluish in the shadows, but for color, I've actually been pretty blown away. I don't do a whole lot of color photography, really, and when I do, I tend to really, you know, enjoy really saturated blues. And at the very least, what I have printed so far, maybe like 5 or 6 color 4x6s of some really, you know, beautiful blue images that I've shot over the years, it's really, really translated that well. So I do have a feeling that, you know, kind of moving forward, a whole bunch of these 4x6s will be some of my rare color photography. And then I'll start experimenting with other paper stocks to find the one that I like for black and white. Mike does speak very, very fondly of the Kodak, professional luster paper, which is really the kind of finish that I enjoy the most, as a perfect kind of medium between a high gloss, not to say that glossy paper reminds everybody of like drugstore prints, but it's kind of what reminds me. Obviously, there's fantastic quality high gloss inkjet paper and you know, certain finishes of like resin coated darkroom paper. But I do kind of prefer that luster finish. It's not exactly gloss, it's not exactly matte either. And you know, they do, multiple different companies do sell those kind of sampler packs of inkjet paper, where they'll have a few sheets of, you know, they're glossy, they're matte, they're luster. And I think that might be a good way for me to kind of dip my toes into a bunch of different companies and a bunch of different paper stocks without having to buy a huge pack and being stuck with something that I don't really enjoy the results from. So I know that Canon has that. I believe Ilford has that. There's also like the Red River paper. There's the Moab paper. It's a whole rabbit hole to fall down. But at the very least, I'm glad that, given my, like, knowing myself and how much I kind of dislike sitting in front of a computer, kind of tweaking images and printer profiles and yada yada yada, I really appreciate the fact that with this HP printer and the Instant Ink program, that's already two variables that are, you know, being kept, you know, the same, controlled. I know that the printer's going to be doing its same thing. Now I can just start choosing which paper I like the look with it, and you know, eventually, you know, once I kind of get to the point where I'm really in the swing of things, I can then be learning over time, okay, this is what I'm seeing on my screen, this is how it's translating in the print, and then making a few edits to the scan in Photoshop, just to kind of get the contrast level I want, the colors that I want. But so far, it's been actually matching, at least for the color, matching what I see on my screen pretty darn closely. So yeah, those are my overall kind of first experiences and first impressions with the HP printer, the HP Envy 5055 all-in-one, and the Instant Ink program. I do believe that my what's it called, my first batch of new ink is already on its way. I think I have about 5 more business days to go. The shipping is a little delayed, which is why it's important to, they say, for you to keep the printer plugged in and connected to the internet, just so that it's kind of constantly communicating with HP headquarters how much ink is in there, you know, when they need to send stuff out, so that you don't, you know, plug it in after not having used it for a couple of weeks and your ink is low, and then it only then will send a message or communicate with HP, letting them know that you're running low on ink, and then you'll have to wait about 10 business days. So just a little tip from my beginning uses with it. Anyway, let's move on to part 2 of the solo show. We have a pretty exciting announcement from, as I said, you know, friend, community member, fellow podcasters, Graham Young of the Homemade Camera Podcast. And the email here says, Mike and Andre, the first zine of the Homemade Camera Podcast is up and ready for download. What's more, it's free. You can go, and we'll put this in the show notes, but you can go to homemadecamera.com/thezine to download it. The contributors include Matt Beckberger, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Dom Silverthorne, Matt Perry, and Dale Willits. The zine is optimized for a computer screen and is in PDF format for anyone to view. We will be putting together a print version, and pre-ordering for the paid print version will be open soon, so you can get to see what you'll be buying ahead of time. The cameras in the zine range from Bizarre, a field view camera the size of a penny, and a camera made from Legos, to the Simply Beautiful. Dom Silverthorne's 4x5 open back pinhole is a work of art in and of itself. Thanks, Nick, Ethan, and Graham from the Homemade Camera Podcast. And you may notice there in the email sign-off, this Ethan character, Mr. Cameradactyl himself, if you guys did not already know, he will actually be joining Nick and Graham as a regular member of the homemade camera podcast. So we're very, very excited for Ethan to be joining on. It's an incredible thing for, you know, not only their podcast, but also our podcast with the Double Exposures Challenge and you know, a few others, to be really kind of embracing the community aspect of this whole thing and putting out an actual visible product in the form of a zine. And I really, really do think that this idea of having the free version, you know, on the PDF, and then an optional pre-ordered paid print version is a great, great way of doing that. It'd be, you know, potentially interesting to talk to Sean Nelson, who really did just an amazing job helping us with the zine version of the Double Exposures Challenge for the Negative Positives podcast, to see if we could maybe do a limited print run. But yeah, huge congratulations to the three gentlemen now of the Homemade Camera Podcast. Definitely check that out in the show notes and consider pre-ordering a print version. PDF zines are awesome and super accessible, but I mean, I think we all really want a print version, don't we? So yeah, congratulations, guys. Really excited to take a look at that. And thank you for being a part of our extended Negative Positives family. It really means a lot. All right, and then final thing that we have, and I say final, but I've been warned that it is 23 minutes long, so I'll be handing over the floor for a decent chunk, technically longer, as I'm looking here at my field recorder, longer than I've actually been speaking for this solo show, which I'm never going to complain about. We do have a call-in camera view from none other but Texas's own film photography, automotive photographer, Eric O'Hara on the Pentax Spotmatic. So over to you, Eric.
Hello, I am Eric O'Hara. I am doing a call-in camera review on the Pentax Spotmatic. I am the same Eric O'Hara that has the oddly spelled name on the Facebook group, and I am the same Eric O'Hara that did the Coco Captain, specifically the Dutch Chocolate Coco Captain on a Negative Positives podcast. My brand is 4x4 Photography, 4XFOURTOGRAPHY. 4x4, or I pronounce it 4x4, just like a pickup truck. That's why I named it like that, 4x4 Photography. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram, and anything else that I do is going to be under that brand name. Anyway, that is enough housekeeping. Let's get on to the camera review. Now, there's a few versions of the Pentax Spotmatic. There's the original that may be branded as Honeywell or Asahi, same camera. It just has a different brand name on top of it based upon who is importing that into the US. The original Spotmatic either will not have anything on the top, which is an OG Spotmatic. That's the original. And then there's a Spotmatic SP, which is the very same camera. There's a Spotmatic 500, which again is the very same camera, except it only goes up to 500 when in reality it goes to 1,000. They just didn't mark the 1,000 on the dial up top. And there's the SP1000, which again is it's the same camera. They just went through a few different branding things. They're all the same camera. You also have a Spotmatic 2, which is supposed to have some slightly better viewfinder, like a brighter viewfinder, if I'm not mistaken. And then it's supposed to have a slightly more accurate spot meter, or rather it's not a spot meter. It's a heavily center weighted meter. It's not really a spot meter, but Spotmatic sounds a lot cooler than center weighted Matic. So I understand why they stuck with that name. So the SP2 has a couple minor differences as far as the notating on the top. On the left side of the winder on all the cameras at the top, around the winder, you can notate if it's color, whether it's daylight or tungsten balance color, if it's panachromatic, or if your film bay is empty. And then on the SP2 and the Spotmatic F, you could also notate whether it was a 20 or 36 count roll inside of your camera. Other than that, and the minor changes through the viewfinder, which, by the way, it looks the same. It's supposed to be a little bit brighter, but to my eye, they're all almost identical. You know, model over model, a Spotmatic for the most part, other than some minor changes, is a Spotmatic. Now, when you get into the Spotmatic F with supported lenses, it's supposed to have wide open aperture metering. I can't say how accurate that is, but one of the downfalls of that is that if you don't have a cap over the lens that's on it, or if it's just the body only, you don't have a lens, if you don't have a cap on the body, basically, if you don't block the light out, it's constantly trying to meter that light, and it will just burn through batteries. It doesn't burn through them nearly as fast. It almost doesn't burn the batteries if you have all light cut off to it, but just the fact that it has electricity running through the metal, the resistance of the metal itself will, over time, eventually burn out your batteries. Luckily, there's a couple battery options for these. I'll talk about those really quick. So your two options are going to be an Energizer 392, and you'll need to put a number 6 rubber gasket around that to get that to fit without sliding around. That way you got a nice tight seal and it's not going to cut in and out. And then you also have the Ween MBR, if I'm not mistaken, MBR. Okay, I just paused it and checked it. It's an MRB. I was close, guys. I was pretty close. The Ween, W-E-I-N, that's the brand, and it's MRB 400. The difference is the Ween is a 1.35 volt, which is what the camera originally called for. Those are pretty expensive. The cheapest I've ever found them is 10 bucks a piece. But the Energizer 392, it's like a 392-380 something, and it replaces. Anyway, the easiest way to search it and find it is the Energizer 392. That's a 1.5 volt battery. However, as long as the bridge circuit in your Spotmatic is still functional, then you can take that, because the camera itself will choke it down to the 1.35 volts required. You just need to put a rubber gasket around that manually, because the Ween battery comes with one built in. But those are your two battery options. If your spot meter is not working, you're either gonna kick it on and it's gonna pretty much sit dead center and not move. You're gonna kick it on and it's just gonna sit at the bottom and not work at all, which means your electronics are completely shot. Or you're gonna kick it on and notice that it is substantially wrong. Like, you put in a 200 speed film and you have the 200 speed selected on your speed indicator dial, and it's metering it like an 800. I mean, it just shows everything overexposed. That's what my two do. So luckily, you're not going to have one that's like one or two stops off. Like, if it's wrong, it's really wrong, and you can notice it. I would say two of the four that I ordered, my original Spotmatics, the oldest version of the Spotmatic, two of those four worked correctly. One of them went off to Mike Gunnerman. He got my backup camera. The other three original Spotmatics I have are pretty regular shooters of mine. The SP2 and the Spotmatic F I just got. I need to do some more testing with them. So this review is mainly going to be over the original Spotmatic. But like I said, other than minor differences, the SP2, the SP, the non-notated Spotmatic that has nothing on it, the SP500, the SP1000 are all essentially the same camera, and then the Spotmatic F has some meter upgrades, and that's about it. It's still the same fully mechanical camera. So your your ISO, or rather ASA selector, goes from 20 up to 1600 on the original Spotmatic. On the SP2 and the Spotmatic F, it goes up to 3200. And because this is full manual, if you have a 30, like a T-Max P3200 in there, and you want to meter it and shoot it at 3200, and you only can do 1600, then meter for 1600 and then give it one more stop of light with your shutter speed, or give it two more stops, or I mean rather one more stop of light via your aperture. It's fully manual. There's no DX coding readers in this. There's no auto winders available. There's no auto features on this. Even other than on your Spotmatic F, which has wide open aperture reading, and even that one, you have the availability to press up and get a stopped down meter. In all your Spotmatics, even your light meter, is you have to manually turn that on with an actual physical lever. It doesn't work by half pressing your shutter like some of the more recent, like 70s and later stuff does. So on the left side of the camera, near where you mount your lens, there's this black lever, or I guess it's more of a push. You push this little black piece of plastic up. I don't know if it's plastic or metal. It's pretty sturdy. Anyway, it's a little black thing on the side of the camera. It has an up arrow on it, and it says SW. You push that up, and you have activated your center-weighted metering system. If I say spot meter, just know that I mean center-weighted meter. It's kind of hard to go back and forth between spot-matic and then center-weighted metering, but it is a center-weighted meter. It's pretty tight to the center, but it's center-weighted. It's not a spot. Anyway, so you turn that on, and it automatically pushes the stop-down pin on the back of your lens so that you get stop-down metering. That way, it's accurate metering, especially on anything prior to the spot-matic F. And then that would meter through your camera. On the right-hand side of the viewfinder is where there is a needle. Dead center will be good exposure a little. And then once you've metered dead center, it's kind of vague about if you're one or two stops under or over. You kind of need to know what a good exposure looks like in your camera. And you need to get familiar with your camera to be able to perfectly, like if you want to go out and use slide film, you need to shoot three or four rolls of color negative, I would think, or three or four rolls of black and white to get used to how your camera meters, because at this age, they're all going to be just a little bit different. And it's definitely a different system than any other camera. But dead center, if that needle is reading dead center, that's pretty much the perfect exposure for that center weighted portion that you're exposing for, and based upon your ASA selection that you made that's on top of the shutter speed dial. If you get a little bit over, you stay within the acceptable range that's shown on the right side that is your meter indicator. And then once you get into sort of this blacked out area, you can still see the tip of your needle, but it's pretty much going off the scale saying like, you're messing your film up, bro. Chill. And same with the negative side of the spot meter. It's pretty basic. It's got a needle. It shows you dead center and then an acceptable range. And then once you're in the black areas, you're pretty well going to mess your film up. But it's not a hard system to use at all. It's very visible. It's very easy to see. And then if you know what kind of film you got, and you know, I got Portra 400, I can expose it by 3, 4, sometimes 5 stops, depending on where in the scene I'm metering, and still get away with it. You've got a lot of leeway. If you're shooting, you know, Velvia 50, you might want to use a hand meter to verify your in-camera results. So let's get on to the shutter speeds. So you have a bulb setting, which, just like any other bulb setting, you press the shutter button and it stays open until you let go of the shutter button or your shutter release. This is threaded for a shutter release cable. And it does have a tripod mount. The only three things on the bottom is your battery bay, a tripod mount, and then your film wind release on the bottom, and then 4 flathead screws to take the bottom apart. That's all that's on the bottom of the camera. So you have your bulb speed, and then you have 1 second all the way up to 1,000th of a second. And this thing, whenever you're using your longer shutter speeds, pretty much from 1/15th and longer, it has this like egg timer sound to it. Just listen. That's 1 second. So it kind of has even the timer on this thing is mechanical. There's nothing that's power driven other than the light meter, which means it's super, super robust. And if it does break, they're pretty easy to get them CLA'd. Here's 1/8 of a second. You don't have it quite as much. And at 1/15th, all you pretty much hear is just the hint of that egg timer. I'm gonna call it an egg timer. I'm not boiling eggs with a Spotmatic, but you get what I'm saying. It's a mechanical timer. That's 1/15th. So it's pretty cool. Anything from above 1/30th. So once you get from 1/60th all the way up to 1/1000th, that sound goes away. And you get a very satisfying sound. It's not crazy loud, but it's definitely not silent. And this even has fresh. I took the cap off of the camera so you can hear the mirror. Here's 1/1000th. And so it's a very satisfying sound. It's not quiet. It's not loud. You don't get the, you know, you don't get a squeaky shutter like a Canon. There's even the shutter curtain in the back. It's not metal. It's, I believe it's leather. So I'll let you hear the camera from the backside. So it goes bulb, and then it has 1/1000th. 1/60th shutter speed is going to be your flash sync speed. It does have a flash sync port on the top. The original Spotmatic does not have a hot shoe. I'm telling you, this thing is full mechanical. Once you get into the SP, first off, the original Spotmatic, which includes, again, the non-notated Spotmatic, the SP, the 500, the 1000, those all come with a cold shoe adapter that kind of slips over the eyepiece in the back. So it'll hold a flash, but it won't directly connect with the camera that way. It has a flash sync port up at the front. I am not a flash shooter, so I don't know the success rate of what all that stuff does. And I'm not saying you shouldn't be a flash shooter. It's not my thing. I typically shoot midday. Or, you know, plenty of daylight. I'm not a portrait photographer. I'm an automotive photographer. So you need one hell of a flash to light up your subject when you're shooting, you know, a 1957 Chevrolet or something like that. I'm just not a flash shooter. I don't see myself doing it. So I don't know how viable or reliable the flash sync ports on the front of these are. But they are there. Once you get in the SP2 and newer, it does have a hot shoe on the top pre-mounted. So there's your flash options. Just like all other cameras, it has a film counter integrated with the top of the winder. So there's that. It does not have a lock. So on your film winder, your rewind lever. So if you are shooting and you accidentally pull up on it, it'll pop the back off. I've never had that happen. I'm not that, I don't mean to sound rude, but I'm not that clueless. Like I know where my hands are at, and you have to slide it up pretty good. I would say about 3/4 inch before it will actually give you some resistance and pull the back open. So even if you got butterfingers, you can slip that thing back and forth without actually activating the release lever. But it's not like, you know, my Nikon F3 or the FM2 that actually has a lock on the... Does the FM2 have a lock? Anyway, I know the F3 does. On your shutter, not your shutter, on your film rewind lever, it doesn't lock into place. Also, if you get to where your hand is pushing back and forth on your rewind your rewinder up at the top left of the camera, that doesn't lock into place as far as spinning either. So if you push it and you kind of make a wrinkle in your film or a spot where it's not taut when you're shooting it, you may mess up that exposure, or you'll get a happy accident if you're into that kind of thing. You just need to be aware of where your hands are at. I've never had that happen. And my first film camera was a Pentax Spotmatic, a bare bones. If you do something wrong, you could theoretically mess your stuff up. Spotmatic, if you're just aware of what you're doing, you don't have any of this stuff to worry about. And really, the less there is on a camera, the less there is to break. So that's one of the perks of the Spotmatic, is that it's a very simple camera. It is the working man's camera. It's a very simple camera. So on the front, you have a timer. I'm going to activate the timer. The way you do that is you wind a fresh frame, a fresh exposure, and then don't hit the shutter release. There's no like two stage to get this thing to work. There's no lever to flip or anything like that. You just pull on the timer on the front, press the little release that's behind the timer, and you let it go. And all the Spotmatics that I have, after it's fired, it keeps on counting for a couple seconds. I don't know if it was like that from factory, if it's just getting like that from age, but I don't have any that stick, and I don't have any that don't fire. So those are pretty reliable as well. I've actually taken a self-portrait with my wife in the front yard before we went out. We don't get dressed up super often anymore, so I was able to, you know, portrait 400, put it up on the hood of the car, no tripod, and just let it go. You can get skins for these at a pretty reasonable price from Aki Asahi. Again, I'm not sponsored by him or anything. I just like the skins that he has out there. So if you see any of my stuff on Facebook that has cool skins, that's where I get it. There's not really a whole lot else to go over with on this camera, so I'll quickly touch on the lenses. The best of the best are going to be your Takumars. The Super Takumar is older. The Super Multi-Coated Takumar are going to be the newer lenses. It is an M42 Pentax screw mount. So sometimes it's referred to as an M42 Pentax screw mount. Sometimes it's just M42 mount or Pentax screw mount. It's all the same. So don't get confused. Pentax only ever had one screw mount. So if they say M42 or Pentax screw mount, it's the same deal. The way those screw mount cameras are made, they sit really close to where the film is at, so they can pretty well be adapted to any modern camera, especially mirrorless. Some of the DSLRs will have mirror slap on some of the close adapters because there's no electronics in it. They're all dumb adapters. I call them dumb adapters. They don't have any sort of electronic pass-through, so they're cheap. They're cost-effective. Some of the better lenses are going to be the 28mm by pen, the 28mm Takumar, the 35, the 50, the 55, and then the 135. Those are pretty much the most sought after. And then the 85, but man, that thing is crazy overpriced. And then, so your Super Takumar and your Super Multi-Coated Takumar, or SMC, it's abbreviated on most of the lenses. The main difference is the coatings on it. So if you're shooting directly backlit in some of the older lenses, as with all lens manufacturers, you'll kind of get a washed out look, which may be something that you're going for. The SMC lenses, a lot of those don't have quite as bad of that, and they also don't have quite as bad of sun flares. And if they are, it's not some crazy like rainbow effect on your image, just a nice clean sun flare. I shoot both Super Takumar and SMC glass. For the most part, I can't tell a huge difference. Unless I'm putting them head to head, I can't tell the difference. They're all great. All of them are full metal construction. And then also you have an enormous third-party support behind M42 glass. You've got the actual Takumar glass. Anything that's labeled Pentax is going to be a K-mount. They didn't actually label their lenses and as Pentax lenses until K-mounts came out. So Takumar is the name brand from Pentax. And then you've got Vivitar, specifically their Series 1 glass is pretty damn good. And then you've got Soligor, you have Yashinon, there's Meyer Optic Gurlitz, there's Helios. You also have Shinon. And then you have fourth party. Anyway, third party lens manufacturers would make them for these big box stores. So you will have Sears, JCPenney, and Kmart lenses. I think Kmart may only be with the K-mount lenses, But I know for sure, because I have a JCPenney and a Sears M42 screw mount. So you have this huge world of lenses. So you can get like a body and three lenses on eBay for $100. If they're asking more than that, they may be trying to rip you, unless it's some real good glass. But this is just an absolute workhorse. It's a simple, basic camera. So if you don't like basic, simple cameras, it may not be for you. But if you want something that is going to work, and if it stops working, you can get it working again for pretty cheap and pretty fast. No electronics other than the meter on the inside. Nothing is electronically driven. It's fully mechanical, and you've got some pretty good features on here. This is probably going to be a good camera for you. Even if you don't really love it, they're so cost effective that you could get one and then decide you don't like it and then sell it on eBay or local for what you paid for it, unless you just got completely ripped off. So it's not like one of the craze cameras that are out right now, where if you buy it and then take 2 or 3 months to sell it, you may end up losing your ass on it. They're pretty steady on the pricing. So that's my call-in camera review of the Pentax Spotmatic, the Honeywell Pentax Spotmatic. The manufacturer is originally Asahi. And thank y'all for bearing through this with me. Go check me out at 4x4 Photography on Facebook or Instagram. And y'all go shoot some cool film photos.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. O'Hara, for your thoughts on the Pentax Spotmatic. I do kind of view that camera very fondly. I sold many, many, many of them while working at a camera store in North Carolina in college. And I think, you know, it really is a great kind of desert island camera, fantastic beginner's camera. And as much as it kind of pains me to admit sometimes, it is, you know, it deserves a special place in the annals of film photography history. And although Mike may be moving away from all of that working man's camera stuff when it comes to 35mm, now that he's got two Leica R series SLRs. I really can't do justice to Mike's pretentious Leica accent, but anyways, guys, thank you so much for listening to this little solo show. Hope you enjoyed it. You can see my film and watch photography on Instagram at AndreOnFilm. Be sure to email this podcast at negpositives@gmail.com with your questions, call-in camera reviews, or literally anything else. Join the Negative Positives Film Photography Podcast Facebook group to keep to date with personal projects, inside jokes, and general hilariosity from our wonderful listeners. And last but not least, do be sure to follow Negative Positives on Instagram, run of course by our friend Bryce Randall, and do use the hashtag #NegativePositives so that Bryce can share your images with the rest of us. Everybody stay positive and shoot some cool film photos. Take care.
Gutter Man Cave Production!